Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO.
Is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll begin with a look at Elon Musk's other project, SpaceX, and how it, too, is failing to uphold a commitment to justice. Indigenous journalist Frank Hopper has written a story for Yes Magazine about the resistance of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe of Texas against SpaceX's launching facility and the infringement of their sacred lands. Then, as we head out of the midterm elections of 2022 and into the Black History Month 2023, We'll speak with Alicia Garza, political strategist, organizer, and author of The Purpose of Power, How We Come Together When We Fall Apart. She's also the founder and principal at Black to the Future Action Fund and Black Futures Lab, and the co-founder of the hashtag Black Lives Matter. Alicia will discuss the efforts of the Black Organizing Innovations Project, the Black Census Project, and more. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Billionaire Elon Musk's poor leadership of Twitter and Tesla has made headlines for months now. But a story that has received little national attention is his years-long takeover of a part of a Texas community near the border for his space technology corporation, SpaceX. Writing in Yes Magazine, Indigenous journalist Frank Hopper details how the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe of Texas has been fighting Musk for control of lands that are sacred to them and that they're regularly cut off from because of SpaceX's launch pad. Frank Hopper Tlingit is a freelance native journalist born in Juneau, Alaska, now living in Tacoma, Washington. His work has appeared in Last Real Indians, The Stranger, and Indian Country Today, and his self-titled YouTube channel features videos about native issues. Welcome to the program, Frank.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about what it is that SpaceX has done in a community roundabout near Brownsville, Texas, near the border. His company, SpaceX, we won't even get into what the company does, but what is, if you can give our audience a sense of the presence of SpaceX and where in Texas that presence is.
Well, the SpaceX launch facility is right at the mouth of the Rio Grande River as it flows into the Gulf of Mexico. And it's locally called Boca Chica, which means little mouth, I guess, in Spanish. And it's a sacred spot to the Carrizo Comecrudo. It's the location of their creation story. The first woman arose from the mouth of the Rio Grande River after she had accepted blessings from all of the creatures along the river that starts originally back up in Colorado. And so it's a very sacred spot for the tribe there. And the SpaceX launch facility is just within maybe 200 yards of the beach right there. And the actual launch tower, if you stood on the beach, you could probably throw a rock and hit it. It's that close. And the SpaceX has never tried to consult with the tribe or gain any sort of consent from them or agreement about how they're going to treat the land. And I personally have tried to contact them several times and they do not respond to me.
So what is the issue with accessing these sacred sites? Give me a sense of how the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe of Texas has, how their access to these sacred lands has been impacted since SpaceX set up its launch pad.
Yeah, well, there's only one road that goes to Boca Chica, to the Boca Chica Beach. It's a Highway 4. And it runs right by the launch tower. And so whenever SpaceX is doing rocket engine tests or they're preparing for a launch, they have the Highway 4 blocked near the launch tower. And so no one, when they're doing those tests, no one can get to the beach. And they have Cameron County Sheriff's deputies blocking it. And so they SpaceX has involved the local governments, the county and city governments, to help them deny access to the beach for tribes, for the Carrizo Comecrudo, when they want to do sacred offerings or on holy days and things like that.
And so I understand that just for things like press conferences and private events, the county has basically given Musk proprietary access. Is this something that Musk sort of has paid for? How does he get the right to this?
Well, I don't know if he actually pays for the right to have the road blocked, but I know he has donated a lot of money to the local governments, to the city of Brownsville, Cameron County, and his presence in that area means a lot to them economically. It means a lot of growth. A lot of techies are moving into the area, and you know, to work for SpaceX, and so the local government is sort of bending over backwards to accommodate them, and they're totally ignoring the concerns of the indigenous people who have lived there for thousands of years.
What does the resistance look like now? Give me a sense of, I mean, the SpaceX has had its launch site there for a few years now. How has the tribe been resisting? How have local communities joined in resisting Musk's basically takeover of this spot of land?
Yeah, they really have. The main thing that they've done is they've joined with two environmental groups, one called Save RGV, and RGV means the Rio Grande Valley, and then with I can't remember the name of the other group.
Is it Sierra Club?
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. Yeah, the Sierra Club. Yeah, so they've joined with them in a lawsuit against Cameron County for allowing SpaceX to block the road. And initially, last May, the judge dismissed the case, but it's now in an appeal. And I think a lot of it is because, I mean, a lot of the problem they're having is that most people don't know about that situation. I think if more people knew about it, the tribe would have listened to more closely, and so that's what I'm hoping my article does, is it brings the issue out into the open for people to become aware of, and basically put a little pressure on SpaceX and Musk and the organization there to at least consult with the tribe and make some sort of agreements or something about the use of the land.
Right. I mean, what's really remarkable is that Texas has an Open Beaches Act, that there's supposed to be public access to beaches, but since SpaceX built its facility, that act has been amended by the Texas State Legislature to allow foreclosures for the space flight activities by Elon Musk. I mean, this is quite remarkable. And so this, I understand, is part of what is being challenged legally. Tell me about Juan Mancias, the tribal chairman of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe of Texas, who you profile in your story for Yes, and tell me about his leadership.
Well, I first met Juan when they set up several camps along the route of the border wall, former President Trump's border wall, because it travels all the way to Boca Chica. It hasn't reached there yet. The construction hasn't completed that far yet, but the wall goes right along the Rio Grande River, just north of it, about maybe 300 yards from the river. And originally the route was going to go through a butterfly refuge center. It was going to go through a cemetery called the Eli Jackson Cemetery where some of the tribe's ancestors are buried. And so as the construction was approaching, Juan and his tribe set up, I think, three different camps where they were just observing what was going on, and they were letting their presence be known. And so I had written an article about them. I think it was back in 2019. And that's how I got to know about their situation. And recently they've also been fighting the construction of a liquefied natural gas plant. There's two of them being planned there for the port of Brownsville, which is just a few miles away. And they have not consulted with the tribe or contacted them in any way. And so it's like the tribe itself has had has been under siege on three fronts. One of them being the border wall, and then are these LNG plants, and now SpaceX. And when I saw, I've been following them for a long time, and they've been friends of mine, and they've always been active in trying to protect the earth. If any tribe in the area is putting on a demonstration or a rally to fight something, they'll join in and support them. And in return, they receive a lot of support from other tribes and environmental groups. So it's been going on for years and years. Juan himself went to Paris a few years ago to speak at a climate change summit there. And so it's like he's fighting. He and his tribe are fighting to kind of save the area, which is kind of an industrial focal point for natural gas, oil, the border wall. You know, there's all sorts of things going on there because it's right at this very important location. You know, it's like the southernmost point in the United States, and it's kind of right in line with a lot of shipping channels, and they want to dredge the Rio Grande River in order to make the LNG plant, you know, able to accept big tanker ships, because they want to produce LNG, and then which is liquefied natural gas, which is like rocket fuel basically, and they'll be loading it into big huge tanker trucks to be shipped to other countries. And so they're just completely inundated. The Carrizo Como Crudo are just surrounded by these different forces in society that are not regarding their presence at all. And they're actually all doing a lot of damage to the environment.
I understand part of the problem is that the Carrizo Como Crudo tribe of Texas is not federally recognized.
Right. Yeah, they're not recognized by the United States, but that's not uncommon. I guess there are like 570 or 80 federally recognized tribes in the U.S., but there are over 200 that are unrecognized, and it's a real complicated process to become recognized or to qualify for recognition. And they've made it, the federal government has made it as difficult as possible to qualify. And so the Carrizo Como Crudo don't have a federal recognition, but they are a valid tribe. They don't have state recognition either, but that's just because the state is following the federal example. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, all of the legislation that's in place to protect Native tribes, such as the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, which is called NAGRA, NAGPRA, and the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, all of those only apply to federally recognized tribes. And so not being recognized means that the tribe has absolutely no power in the court or according to the government. They have no actual legal power to stop.
As a body, as an entity together, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It makes it difficult for them to get people to listen to them. I mean, even companies that are involved in development there, they have no legal obligation to contact the Carrizo Como Crudo because they're not recognized, because the tribe isn't recognized. And so here's this tribe that's fighting for the earth, and yet no one will listen to them because they don't have this kind of stamp of approval from the federal government.
I want to play for our audience an excerpt of a video that you created about this fight that the Carrizo Carme Crudo tribe is leading against SpaceX's launch pad in the southern Texas border region.
For thousands of years, the ancestors of the Carrizo Carme Crudo tribe of Texas have honored the mouth of the Rio Grande River as a sacred site, the location of the tribe's creation story.
This is our sacred site. This is Boca Chica Beach. Right here is the birthing place of our people. This is the Boca Chica. This is where first woman was born. Hey, I'm here with my buddy.
In April, Juan Mancias, chair of the Carrizo Carme Crudo tribe, and two companions attempted to make offerings at Boca Chica Beach on one of the tribe's holy days. But they were stopped by a Cameron County Sheriff's deputy.
I wish that I could let you through, but I can't.
That's against the American Indian Religious Freedom Act.
The what?
The American Indian Religious Freedom Act.
Oh, I don't know, sir. That was, I mean, you could go at 11 o'clock when we open it up.
In May, the tribe joined the environmental groups Save RGV and the Sierra Club in a lawsuit against Cameron County and the Texas General Land Office, stating that blocking access to a public beach violates the Texas Constitution.
But all this place is sacred. There's people buried here. Our villages are here on both sides. That's Mexico over there.
Becca Hinojosa, senior Gulf Coast representative for the Sierra Club, points out the elitist nature of the beach closures.
Monday through Friday, every week, SpaceX closes the beach from the early morning until like 10 p.m. Cameron County has closed the beach to allow SpaceX and Elon Musk to have like press conferences and to use the beach for their own events. Yeah, that's wrong. People have been going there for generations. Those are sacred land of the Carrizo Carme Crudo tribe. People need to go out there and fish to feed their families. And, you know, Cameron County is just allowing a billionaire to, you know, close it for his own parties. You know, that's ridiculous.
In addition to blocking access to the beach, SpaceX plans to expand the launch center next year, adding more launch pads and a larger support facility, potentially destroying ancient village sites buried in the fragile marshland. SpaceX is not the only threat to the traditional lands of the Carrizo Carme Crudo. On November 3rd, the tribe issued a cease and desist order to stop construction of a liquefied natural gas plant on Garcia Pasture, an archaeological site about 1,000 years old where the tribe's ancestors came and fished for generations. The tribe, which has between 1,200 and 1,500 members, continues upholding its culture and traditions, fighting for its rights and for its ancestors.
And that is an excerpt of a video created by my guest, Frank Hopper, an indigenous journalist who has written for Yes Magazine about how tribes like the Carrizo Carme Crudo tribe of Texas are challenging Elon Musk and defending native sacred sites from the likes of tech billionaires like him and projects like SpaceX in particular. So Frank, let's talk about how the local community is also responding. This is a primarily Latino community in Brownsville. Isn't the influx of tech workers into this area because of SpaceX also leading to sort of rapid gentrification, which I imagine the tribe is also affected by?
Yeah, exactly. There's a housing village there right at Boca Chica where there's probably maybe 70 or 80 little ranch houses along this Boca Chica Boulevard, just right off the beach. And as soon as Musk kind of moved in there or started moving in there and building the launch center, he went to all of the residents of those houses and said, "We're buying you out." And they gave them, they made an offer on each of the houses, and they just moved everybody out. And now they're using those houses to put up their tech employees. And there's, in addition to those employees, as the Launch Center is being expanded, there's going to be more employees brought in, and they're going to be moving into Brownsville. And they're probably high paid, you know, high tech employees, and it's probably going to raise housing prices. It's probably going to affect a lot of different things in the village there. There's one anecdote that happened just last spring, where one of the activists for the Sierra Club allegedly spray painted some graffiti on a mural that had been painted that had been commissioned by Elon Musk. And the idea was this: Elon Musk had decided he was going to get in good with the local people, and you know, he was kind of making donations here and there, and he wanted to have a mural painted at a certain location. And so he went out of the area and found an artist, when there were many artists in the ethnic artists in the area that could have done a wonderful job, but he didn't take the time to look into it. It's as if he has no real concern or care at all about where he is building this massive toxic rocket launch site. The activist that allegedly did the graffiti on the mural was treated really harshly. It was a young woman, and they when they found out, or they decided who it was, they sent in armed police officers into her house and cuffed her up right there and took her out of here. What she did was basically a misdemeanor, you know, but they were treating her as if she were a terrorist. And that speaks to just how closely the local government is tied in with Elon Musk. You know, they're willing to kind of like be his henchmen. Yeah. And I'm not sure what the status of the charges are with that young woman, whether or not, when I spoke to her a couple months ago, it was still pending. I mean, it was still, there had not been a decision about whether or not she was guilty of it or not, or what was going on. But she wound up spending a few hours in jail for something that they should have given her a ticket for. And, you know, there is so much support for Musk and SpaceX in South Texas that he can pretty much do anything he wants. He can completely just ignore the concerns of people that don't have power. And so that's basically what's going on, I believe.
Frank, do you see parallels between this fight, between this fight in South Texas and the much bigger profile and fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline? This was, you know, several years ago. Of course, I'm sure many in our audience recall the fight that drew thousands of people, especially indigenous folks and journalists from around the country, to the site of the Dakota Access Pipeline project to resist it, only to find that the local government was basically acting as though they were, you know, as you put it, henchmen of the company, and you know, mercenaries, if you will, for the corporation.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities. There's actually like two or three different pipelines that are bringing natural gas to Brownsville. There's the Valley Crossing pipeline, the Rio Bravo pipeline, you know, and they all have the potential for doing damage to the environment. And I think the conflict at Standing Rock kind of arose at a time when people were starting to become aware of these issues, and so it got a lot of press, and then and a lot of people went to that location, and so it got a lot of national press too. But in reality, what the Carrizo Comecrudo are facing is much worse. They're not fighting one pipeline, they're fighting several, and a spaceport, and an LNG facility, and Trump's border wall. And yet no one, I mean, a lot of people have, a lot of really good hunter people have come to South Texas and volunteered and things like that. But it hasn't really received the kind of publicity or the kind of support that the conflict at Standing Rock did. And I think that's just kind of unfortunate. I think it's if people really knew all the facts, you know, it would receive a similar amount of support.
Is there a support from local communities for the fight led by the tribe in South Texas?
Well, there's an active environmentalist presence there, especially from the Sierra Club. And there's a lot of good people that are fighting within those organizations to keep these projects from doing further damage. But I don't really know exactly if they're, you know, if the vast majority of people in South Texas are first off really aware of what's going on, and second off, they support it for the most part, because I think it's bringing in jobs and money, and I mean, which it already has, and to them, that's the most important thing. It's sort of like money trumps the earth, and it's just so sad that it's like that.
Well, Frank, we're going to link to your story for Yes Magazine from our website. Would you like to give out any links either to your YouTube channel or other places people can read your writings?
Sure, yeah. I've changed the name of my YouTube channel. It's now called The Tlingit Zone, sort of like the Twilight Zone. So, as I write articles, I'm also making videos to go along with them. I'm trying to publish something at least once a month. And so if people kind of, if they were able to be subscribed to my YouTube channel, they'd kind of be up to date on what I'm up to.
And we'll post a link directly to the channel as well. Frank, thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My guest has been Frank Hopper Tlingit. He is a freelance native journalist born in Juneau, Alaska, now living in Tacoma, Washington. His work appears in Last Real Indians, The Stranger, and Indian Country Today, as well as Yes Magazine. His YouTube channel is called The Tlingit Zone, and we will link to the story that we've just been discussing from our website, but you can find it directly at yesmagazine.org about Native tribes are challenging Elon Musk and SpaceX in South Texas. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. As we head toward Black History Month 2023, the Black Futures Lab is organizing a second round of its Black Census project. When it was first launched in 2019, it was the largest survey of Black people since Reconstruction. Here is Black Futures Lab founder and principal Alicia Garza explaining the significance of the Black Census Project at an event organized by the Commonwealth Club of California.
And we said, how can we talk to as many Black people as possible in advance of the 2020 election to find out what we experience every single day in the economy, in our democracy, in our society, and to ask a question that people don't get asked very frequently, which is, what do you want to see for your future?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And our plan is to use that data to inform a policy agenda that we then move in 2020 that is informed by more than 30,000 responses from Black people from diverse communities across the nation that will not only supplant the idea that Black people are a monolith,
yes,
but it will also give contour to what it is that Black people want to see. And I'll just give you the sneak peek right now.
Please do.
What Black people want is what everybody wants.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
A good life. To live well, to keep your family together, to make sure your family is healthy, safe, and whole, to make sure that your children can grow up to be adults, to make sure that you have access to care when you need it, to make sure that the people you love have access to care when they need it, and that it's not gonna break your bank, right? So surprise, that's the big secret. Black folks want what everybody wants.
That's Alicia Garza in 2019 at an event organized by the Commonwealth Club of California. As the new Congress of 2023 begins taking up legislation, fresh from a bizarre internal Republican Party fight over the position of House Speaker, already political strategists are thinking about the presidential race of 2024. Voting rights are still under attack, and gerrymandered districting remains prevalent. But the painstaking work of grassroots organizing is also going strong. Alicia Garza now joins me for an interview to discuss these efforts. Alicia is a political strategist, organizer, and author of The Purpose of Power, How We Come Together When We Fall Apart. She is the founder and principal at Black to the Future Action Fund and Black Futures Lab, and the co-founder of the hashtag Black Lives Matter. Welcome to the program, Alicia.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your organizations that you are the principal of, the Black Futures Lab and Black to the Future Action Fund, tell me a little bit about the work that you embarked on right after last year's midterm elections. I understand that there is a work that's being done to infuse Black-led voting rights organizations around the country with the resources that they need in order to prepare for what we know is always going to be politically fraught, which is, of course, the presidential race and all of the other down-ballot races as well in 2024.
That's right. So what we did is we established what we're calling a Black Organizing Innovations Program. And the reason that we did that is because we know every single election cycle, we are lamenting and wringing our hands about how Black communities are under-engaged or engaged at the last minute. And so what ends up happening every single cycle is that people get confused, concerned, about how Black people are going to participate, whether or not Black people are going to participate. And in a lot of ways, you know, this is a never-ending cycle that we hope to make an intervention in. What we know about Black community participation is that Black communities participate in elections at higher levels, right, than many other racial or ethnic groups. And it's because Black communities have a lot at stake and a lot on the line. But the other reason that Black communities participate regularly and often is especially when we are engaged year-round and not 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or 4 weeks before an election cycle. We really wanted to invest in organizations that have a strategy of year-round activation of Black communities, not just when we want something, right? But making sure that we are there every single step of the way to encourage and help germinate Black political participation, not just during election cycles, but everywhere in between. With the Black Organizing Innovations Program, we are resourcing creative ways that organizations are using in Black communities to keep our communities engaged between election cycles. What we know and what we believe is that infusing those organizations and those strategies with resources to keep our communities engaged will play out better for us in the next election cycle. Research shows that when Black communities are engaged early and all the time, that we will participate in elections. And so we are trying to help encourage that participation by resourcing what is often not resourced, which is the work that it takes to be the glue between election cycles.
Now, since the donations were made, the funding was given after last November's elections, there was already, I understand, one test of it. Of course, in Georgia, we had a Senate runoff race, and the organization Black Voters Matter, which has been one of the most important on the ground organizations for years now, engaging and mobilizing Black voters in the South. Tell me a little bit about what they did.
Well, we partnered with Black Voters Matter to do a Wakanda Votes Forever activation. As you know, Wakanda Forever was released just before the election, and Black communities far and wide were rushing to the theaters to see the next installment of Black Futures and what that looks like. And for us, it was important to support Black Voters Matter in the work that they were trying to do to keep Black communities engaged. Here's what we know. What we know is that organizations like Black Voters Matter were deeply underfunded to do the work that our country depends on to keep Black communities engaged. We love the work of Black Voters Matter, but when it comes to actually resourcing them, right, and making sure they have the tools and the money that they need to do the incredible work that they do, being the glue for communities and bridging the gap, right, between what government does to engage us in the decisions that impact our lives and the decisions themselves, it's asinine to me to hear a group like Black Voters Matter, which is doing some of the most important voting rights work in the country, to hear them say that they don't have the resources that they need to do the work that we depend on them for. So we definitely did gratefully and happily move resources to that organization. And we also partnered with them. And so what that meant was that we were getting people involved and excited after they had been voting a lot in the previous couple of months. And we also got people looking future forward. We had people taking the Black census to let us know about what their policy priorities were moving into 2023. And of course, an upcoming cycle where we'll be deciding who leads this nation in 2024. And we're hoping that more partnerships like that can and will happen through the Black Innovations Organizing Project. We are resourcing organizations throughout the South, throughout the Midwest, and a couple in California to do that necessary work to keep our communities engaged in the process of democracy. Democracy doesn't begin or end with casting your vote. Democracy is a project that needs to ensure that all of our communities are responsible for what happens in the state legislatures and in the White House. And in order to do that, we need to make sure that our communities are being engaged consistently, and we need to make sure that our communities' priorities are being heard.
You mentioned the Black Census Project. Tell me about this. It sounds very ambitious, the largest survey of Black people in the U.S. since Reconstruction. But it was done a couple of years. It started a couple of years ago, right? Several years ago.
That's right. The Black Census Project is currently the largest survey of Black people in America since Reconstruction. And we did launch it in 2018. It was the very first program of the Black Futures Lab. And the goal of it was to really better understand from Black communities ourselves what we were experiencing every single day in relationship to the economy, our democracy, our society, and bigger than just the problems that we're facing, we really wanted to understand what solutions Black communities wanted to see to address some of the biggest problems of our generation. We take those solutions and we turn them into policy that works for our communities, and we try to get that policy passed in cities and states across the country. What we know now, going into another interesting political era is again that Black communities are being undercounted and underengaged. And that has devastating consequences for whether public policy is in fact public, meaning does public policy reflect the needs, the concerns, and the experiences of Black communities who certainly disproportionately feel the negative impacts of public policy that does not address our needs. And so we decided to relaunch the Black Census Project to become the largest survey of Black people in American history. And we are well on our way. We are collecting 200,000 responses to the Black Census Project. You can still take the Black Census at blackcensus.org. And we'll be using the data from this project to inform our legislative priorities going into the 2024 election cycle. Again, you can take the Black Census at blackcensus.org, and you can still participate.
So you're basically calling on Black Americans around the U.S. to go and voluntarily express what it is that they want to see. But I imagine that there's also just a lot of mobilization because it's, you know, it's one thing to ask people to go to a website, another thing to actually engage with them. So getting 200,000 people to go on and take the census is pretty remarkable. What are the sort of questions that are being asked? Because we know that surveys especially can be so politicized. You can, you know, kind of massage questions to get the results that you want always. And it tends to skew what it is that people actually want.
Well, here's what's so great about the Black Census Project. Number one, it's a nonpartisan survey. So we are not looking for people who just agree with us. We're looking for responses from Black people from every position on the political spectrum. You don't have to be an activist. You don't have to be somebody who believes in social justice. What we want is to have you have your voice heard. We want to better understand the needs, experiences, and priorities of Black people in America. And what that means too is that you don't have to be an American citizen to take the Black Census if you are Black. We are surveying Black people in America, not just Black Americans. The other thing that's really important about the Black Census Project is that you don't have to give any of your personal information to participate. We allow you to do that if you want to opt in so that you can be engaged in campaigns and in our partners' work to achieve some of the solutions that you might identify, but we don't require it for you to be a part of history. And that tends to be something that can turn people off from surveys, is that they're concerned about where their personal information will go. They're concerned about whether or not their personal information is going to get sold to somebody they don't want it to go to. We don't require you to give us that information in order to have your voice heard and your needs and your experiences prioritized. Last thing I'll say that's important about the Black Census is that we do offer opportunities for you to be a part of the solution. We don't just want to collect data. We want to make that data live and real in the service of transforming your everyday life for the better. And what that means for us is working with partners all across the country to run policy campaigns in cities and states across the nation that change the rules about how Black communities are resourced, that change the rules about how Black communities can participate, and that change the rules about the conditions of Black communities. And that's why it's important that if you are a Black person living in America, that you participate in the Black Census Project. And again, you can participate at blackcensus.org.
So we talked about resourcing organizations and then surveying what people want. Let's talk about how individual organizers are also being trained and why that's important. The Black Policy Institute has graduated or will be graduating in the next few months almost 100 Black organizers that are going to be doing some very important work. Tell me about this aspect of the organizing work that it's going to take to have a sort of multi-spectrum approach to elections and democracy and voting.
The reason that we started the Black Public Policy Institute at the Black to the Future Action Fund and the Black Futures Lab is because we want our communities to be equipped with the tools that we need to make the rules and change the rules. And at the end of the day, when we think about laws and policies that impact our lives, most of the time, our communities are not involved in the development of those processes, but we certainly are impacted by them. And so we want to change that equation. We think that Black communities deserve to be the people who are making the rules and changing the rules that are shaping our lives every single day. And so with this 8-month policy fellowship, we take Black organizers from across the country and we help to train Black communities how to write, win, and implement new rules in cities and states across the nation. You're not just in a program where you get a training booklet and then you're sent off with a certificate. We actually have you in this program design the policies that you want to see enacted in your city or in your state. And we help support you through an actual legislative cycle, get that policy passed. And we've been successful in places like California. We worked with the Young Women's Freedom Center to make sure that we changed the rules about sentencing guidelines for young women who were coerced into committing crimes as a result of being in a domestic violence partnership or an intimate partner violence partnership where they were coerced into committing a crime. We want to make sure that the needs of our communities are being addressed, and that's a great example of how we do that. And so the program is rigorous. This program resources organizers to participate. So it's not something that you have to do on your own time, on your own dime. We are really looking to build the capacity of organizations to be able to learn and know how to make the rules and change the rules that are impacting families and communities in your city and in your state. The other thing that is so important about this program is that you get mentorship from experts that are policy advocates and know how to do the things that we're trying to train you in particular in your area of expertise. And finally, the thing that is so awesome about this program is it's really, really Black. We have Black trainers. We have Black participants. We are using the experiences and the cultural competency in Black communities to train our communities on how to make the rules and change the rules. It's a very unique program that we're so honored to be able to offer to our communities. And we're already seeing the results, and we're deeply grateful and humbled to everyone who has trusted us with this process. And I can tell you that of the 80 plus fellows that have graduated from this program, we've gotten incredible feedback about how important and useful this is, not just for individuals, but building the ecosystem and infrastructure in our communities to be more powerful politically.
Alicia Garza, we are heading into or toward Black History Month, and you are someone who has attempted to really uplift the idea of Black futures and looking forward and envisioning what future and just future could look like. How do you link history to the future? What are the most important lessons that you take from Black history as you envision a just future?
One of the most important things that I take from Black history is that Black communities have always been futurists. Because of the way that the rules have been rigged against our communities, we've been forced to imagine a new future with possibilities for freedom. And that's why during Black History Month, the Black Futures Lab spends our time focusing on the future. We take lessons from the past, we take experiences from the present, and we take this opportunity to really reimagine what our futures can and should look like with all of us working together towards a common goal. For me, what Black Futures Month offers us the opportunity to do is to reimagine a just society, a just democracy, and a just economy where everyone has what they need to thrive and where nobody is getting left behind merely on the kind of merits, right, of you know, our race or our gender, our sexuality, our disability, our immigration status. We believe that all Black people deserve to be powerful in every single aspect of our lives. And Black Futures Month is really an opportunity for us to reflect on the work that we've done thus far to get us there and the work that we still need to do to keep us going.
And then when we think about how organizing happens today versus 20, 30, 50 years ago, we do live in a very different world. And yet, of course, there are things that are the same. But the biggest difference is digital technology, which has its upsides and its downsides. How do you harness the best of technology to ensure that those things that, you know, people were fighting for 50 years ago can still be realized, you know, using these new tools?
I think the trick is to make sure that what stays consistent across generations and across eras of organizing is the building of personal relationships. What we know about organizing in the 30s, in the 40s, and organizing in the 2000s, the 2010s, and the 2020s is that organizing and moving something together requires relationships. What technology allows us to do is build relationships across physical or geographical barriers, but it still requires relationship building. You cannot meme your way to justice. You cannot reel your way to justice, right? The path forward is to make sure that we know each other, that we're connected, that we know that we depend on each other to survive. And so it's important for us to remember to nurture the relationship building aspect. And sometimes that can't happen only behind a screen. Sometimes screens and technology can help facilitate bringing us together with people that we wouldn't be able to do so otherwise. But we have to make sure that there's other work that's happening to deepen those relationships beyond the screens, beyond the hashtags, and beyond the memes.
Alicia, one last question, if you don't mind. We've had 2.5 years since the racial justice uprising of 2020, and the spark for that was the brutal murder of George Floyd. People marched in the streets for racist police brutality to end, but organizers like yourself, who had been active for many years before, put that into a broader context of what freedom means, and it's not just freedom from police brutality. And yet, Black people are still getting killed by police. Patrice Cullors' cousin was just tasered by LAPD fatally. We've seen reports that more people in general, more Americans were killed by police in 2022 than any year before that. It was a record-breaking year for police killings. Why? Why has greater public attention and these record-breaking protests that took place in 2020, why have they not had seemingly an impact on even just this one aspect, one critical aspect, which is racist police brutality?
Well, I would argue that they have had an impact, but it's not enough of an impact. And what I think we're getting to here is that the racial reckoning, quote unquote, of 2020 is not complete. And it's interesting to see these reckonings happen in various cycles. You know, achieving racial justice cannot just be symbolic. We cannot just put up signs in our windows and not change laws. We cannot just post a hashtag or black out our profile pictures and not hold police accountable when they commit crimes in our communities. It's important for us to reimagine public safety, to stop investing the resources that we are investing in policing and thinking that it's going to get us to some kind of racial justice goal. It will not. What gets us to racial justice is making sure that people have the things that they need to survive and thrive. What gets us to racial justice is making sure that the rules are applied evenly across the board, whether that be in government, whether that be in policing. And what gets us to racial justice is ensuring that We are not allowing for uneven and unequal outcomes based on your race, your gender, your sexuality, your disability status, or your citizenship status, amongst other things. The racial reckoning is not completed, and it doesn't get complete just by saying Black Lives Matter. We have to enact policies and change rules and hold people accountable in order to reach the goals that we seek. And that is an ongoing project that we cannot afford to abandon.
Right. It's easy to get disengaged and discouraged, but I really appreciate all of the work that you do, Alicia Garza. What's the best website for people to find out about your work? You're involved in so many different organizations. We'll post links, of course, to several of them, but if there was one thing that you wanted people to come away with, where can they follow up with what we've been talking about online?
You can check out everything that we're up to at blackfutureslab.org. You can take the census at blackcensus.org, and you can follow us on social media at Black Futures Lab and Black, the number two, the Future Action.
And we'll post links again to those. Thank you so much, Alicia, for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Alicia Garza, political strategist, organizer, author of the book, The Purpose of Power, How We Come Together When We Fall Apart, and founder and principal at Black to the Future Action Fund and Black Futures Lab, and co-founder of the hashtag Black Lives Matter. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcasts on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio.